Hello, I'm Ivan Berg, and this is my story. Part 3, 1953 continued. All the photographs of the Windmill Girls were taken by the Windmill Publicity Officer, Kenneth Bandy, who was also a self-taught photographer. The studio that I worked for did all his film processing and printing, as well as having a separate glamour studio. As I said, I got the job, but there was no nude or glamour photography for me. I was to start off in the darkroom, developing, fixing and washing batches of 10x8 prints, and then feeding them into a big rotary glazing machine. These were the prints that the Windmill Theatre punters could buy. There were hundreds of them. I stole some of the best ones. Then, just a few weeks into the job, the skin on my fingers started to itch and tiny white blisters appeared. The doctor said it was chiropomphylax, contact dermatitis caused by my exposure to photographic chemicals. He said I had to use rubber gloves. I tried, but the batches of prints kept slipping out of my fingers. I asked the chief photographer if I could work in the studio, and he shook his head. So I had to leave. Meanwhile, I had to have a job, so continued as assistant to Monty until I could bear it no longer and left to join City Sale and Exchange Photographic in Leadenhall Street in the city as a sales assistant. My knowledge of photography got me the job. The shop had a 16mm film library and projector hire service in the basement, and I was put in charge. I bought my first decent camera, a Voigtlander Percio with an f3.5 Tessar lens on hire purchase, and gave Michael my Bakelite Perma Special. I stayed at City Sale and Exchange long enough to borrow a projector and a couple of films to show Michael and my parents. The films were silent. The Bell & Howell 630 sound projectors with their separate loudspeaker box were far too heavy to take on a bus. It never occurred to me to take a taxi home. I don't remember any family members ever hiring a cab. It so happened that Leadenhall Street was home to a host of shipping company head offices and the offices of the UK Shipping Federation, the Shipping Companies Employers Association. There was a poster in one of the windows featuring the Federation's National Sea Trading School, the T.S. Vindicatrix at Sharpness in Gloucestershire. The school offered free training to boys from 15 to 16 years old for entry into the British Merchant Navy. On impulse, one lunchtime, I went inside. I spoke to a uniformed recruiting officer who told me that I could avoid national service if I joined the Merchant Navy, and that I could choose between deck or catering training. But as I was so young, I also needed parental permission. Apart from avoiding national service, I really had no idea what I was letting myself in for, but going to sea appealed as a romantic notion. After all, Jack London, C.S. Forrester, Captain Marryat, Herman Melville, and lots of other writers went to sea, and maybe I could be a writer too. I left the Shipping Federation office with a thoughtful look on my face and a form in duplicate that required parental signature. If one or both my parents gave their consent, I could just make a sea school intake starting the following week. My parents received the news that I wanted to join the Merchant Navy with disbelief. My mother was upset. My father was taken aback. Both felt it was happening too quickly, that I hadn't thought it through, which was true, that it wasn't a job with prospects, and I'm sure that as far as my mother was concerned, 16-year-old Jewish boys just didn't join the Merchant Navy, which, as I was shortly to discover, was also true. I lied and said that I had thought about it. I wanted to join the Navy and see the world. I said it would take the place of National Service, not knowing that in order to avoid 2 years in the armed forces, I would have to serve 9 years in the Merchant Navy, something the recruiting officer neglected to mention. There was a deadline. If I was to make next week's sea school intake, the signed form had to be returned the following day. In the end, with some reluctance because of the timescale, my father signed the document. I think that he secretly liked the idea. He said that it could make a man of me, and having been in the army himself, that it was certainly better than National Service. The signed consent form was handed in to the Shipping Federation office. I gave City Sale and Exchange, the photographic shop, 4 days' notice, collected my rail pass and a list of items to pack from the Shipping Federation, and spent a nervous and sleepless weekend waiting for the off. On Monday, the 16th of February, 1953, my mother, despite my protests, escorted me and a new cardboard suitcase to Paddington Station for a tearful farewell. I had escaped my East End Jewish background, and a new world beckoned. The National Sea Training School was based at Sharpness in Gloucestershire, on a training ship called the T.S. Vindicatrix. It was actually an old hulk moored on a canal. Accommodation at the sea school was in a bunch of huts on a hillside overlooking the canal. It was a miserable 53 days. The food was stodgy, consisting mainly of potatoes and stews, fish stews, meat of all kinds stews. Breakfast was watery porridge, greasy bacon, cold toast and tea, so stewed that the only thing that could be said for it was that it was wet, warm and brown. The school could accommodate up to 500 trainees, though I don't think it was full on my intake. The boys were separated into catering and deck training schools. We catering boys wore our itchy navy serge uniforms, and the deck boys wore boiler suits because they would get dirty learning how to deal with mooring hawsers, while we would learn how to be a properly trained steward and serve at table. It was cold, very cold. We were wakened at icy dawns, shouted at and shaken. Then a rush to the showers and lavatories hut, washing and shaving in lukewarm water, drying off with thin, scratchy towels. Then charging to the hulk, Vindicatrix, for breakfast. It was here on board that we took turns serving the instructors at table and were lectured on the importance of hygiene and having regular bowel movements. I never saw myself as a natural silver service waiter, but the instructors must have thought I showed promise because, together with one other trainee, I was able to sew the maximum number of 3 blue stars on the left sleeve of my serge uniform blouson. The other trainee, one Nick Britton, was awarded an extra double-size senior star and was made the captain's tiger. Nick had a bit of an advantage over the rest of us because he had worked as a commis waiter in a posh London restaurant prior to sea school. The captain's tiger was the name given to the captain's personal steward, and on the T.S. Vindicatrix it came with privileges, such as the same food as the captain, and not having to attend some of the repetitive and boring stewarding training sessions. There were few ways to relieve the tedium. There was a recreation hut with a billiard table, a jukebox that was forever playing Shrimp Boats Are A-Comin' by Joe Stafford, table tennis with a couple of bats with peeling surfaces and never more than one ball. Soft drinks were available. At the weekend, we had enough time off to take a bus into the nearest town. Dursley boasted a cinema and a couple of tea shops. As we were in sea school uniform, we were made to feel unwelcome, so I only went a couple of times. I learned later that juvenile delinquents, that is, boys in trouble with the law, were often given the option by magistrates of an approved school or borstal, or going to the National Sea Training School. Most, but not all of these, were made to take the 10-week deck training course to become proper sailors, hauling ropes and steering ships and such like. I don't recall any juvenile delinquents on the catering course, although Nick Britton, in an unguarded moment, told me that he would never have volunteered. Most of the chatter consisted of the rewards of working on one of the many passenger liners then sailing the globe. Tips and girls. Someone knew someone who worked in first class on a P&O boat who not only made more than £100 in tips each way on the 6-week voyage to Australia, but had the tourist class female passengers queuing up for his attentions. We all knew for certain that long sea voyages turned girls into raving sexpots. The catering course was 8 weeks. Stewarding, serving at table, cleaning officers' cabins, real servant stuff. The last 2 weeks were much more interesting. Lifeboat training consisted of rowing the school's one and only ancient lifeboat up and down the canal, learning to set the lug sail and, if there was any wind, actually sailing the boat for a few yards. We boxed the compass by chanting all 32 points of the compass in clockwise order. We learnt how to find the North Star. I was looking forward to finding out how to use a sextant, but was disappointed to learn that we catering boys weren't taught it, and I certainly didn't fancy transferring. Nevertheless, I gained my lifeboat proficiency certificate, which meant that I could take charge of a lifeboat, and my catering certificate, which meant that I knew how to serve at table and be a cabin steward. All that now remained, all that stood between me and the romantic ideal inspired by Jack London et al., was getting a job on a ship, preferably a passenger liner. Our very last lecture was given by an embarrassed instructor and was all about the perils of venereal disease, graphically illustrated with a World War II Ministry of Information film made for the armed forces. We were told always to use a prophylactic and that these would be freely available on all British ships. To those of us confused by the word, it was further explained as French letter or Johnny or rubber or even Durex. We were given rail passes home, some cash, not much, probably a couple of pounds, and an envelope addressed to the Shipping Federation office at our local port, in my case, Port of London, and told that we had to sign on to the first ship the office sent us to in order to get our seaman's record book and certificates of discharge. Only then would we be proper members of the British Merchant Navy. Only two of us took the London train. Nick Britton, the captain's tiger, also had an envelope for the Port of London office. We'd become fairly friendly, though at a bit of arm's length, to tell the truth. There'd been a well-known boxer called Jack Kid Berg, who fought in the 1920s and 30s, and Nick had decided that I would be known, at least to him, as the Kid. Nick was worldly. He had a bit of the strut about him. He affected a long cigarette holder. He was taller than me. He was fair-haired and very good-looking. I envied his self-assurance. The train had a restaurant car with a bar. Nick suggested we get a drink to celebrate leaving C school. I mumbled that we were underage. "Come on, kid," said Nick. "Have a drink. What'll you have?" "I'm having a gin and tonic." The only alcohol I had ever drunk was the syrupy, kosher Palwin Passover wine kept in the 1930s cocktail cabinet that took pride of place in the prefab's living room. I'd had a few sips and felt sick. I remembered one of my uncles saying it was a bit like port, which he explained was a wine fortified with brandy. "I'll have a port and lemon," I said. Despite a raised eyebrow at the port and lemon request, which Nick told me was a pub drink favoured by old ladies, the gin and tonic and my port and lemon were served up by an expressionless British Rail barman. "This one's on me," said Nick, when I offered to pay for my drink. I think it was 1 and 6 pence. What happened next is a bit blurred, mostly due to the effects of 2 or more port and lemons, and I think a shandy or two. Nick produced a pack of senior service cigarettes, offered me one. I took it, accepted a light from a rather swish silver Ronson lighter, puffed a few times, and then started to cough. So, before the train reached Paddington, I had my first bar-bought alcoholic drinks and my first cigarette. And I felt ill. Nick's gin and tonics seemed to have little effect. He suggested that I go home with him and go on to Hackney when I felt better. His mum lived in Holborn, quite a bit closer to Paddington than Hackney. "She's a bit bohemian," warned Nick. "She lives with an artist." "Let's take a cab," said Nick. I couldn't tell him it was my first ever. At number 3 John Street, Holborn, a large and imposing Georgian terrace building, Nick paid off the cab and rang one of the doorbells. A window opened right at the top. A head popped out, went in, and then popped out again and threw down a set of keys. The sign on the door said African Inland Mission, first floor. So, up the wide stone staircase we climbed, past the African Inland Mission and all the way to the top, to a door that looked like the entrance to the attic. More stairs this time, much narrower, and covered with a sort of textured red linoleum. A shock awaited me at the top. A naked woman was washing the floor. She stood up and extended a hand. "I'm Rene," she said. "This is the kid," said Nick. "And this is my mum, Rene." "I'm Ivan Berg," I said, looking straight ahead. "Go in and sit down," she said, "and I'll make some coffee. You look like you need some." Nick said Rene always washed the floor with no clothes on, as it was easier to have a bath than wash clothes that got dirty washing a floor. So within the space of a few hours, I had bought a real drink at a bar, had my first cigarette, my first ride in a taxi, and seen my first naked woman, a small, dark-haired and very well-proportioned naked woman who was my C school friend's mum.